The 12th. A day of investigations and discoveries. A more interesting day for many reasons than I had ventured to anticipate. I began my sightseeing, of course, with the house. The main body of the building is of the time of that highly overrated woman, Queen Elizabeth. On the ground floor, there are two hugely long galleries with low ceilings lying parallel with each other and rendered additionally dark and dismal by hideous family portraits, every one of which I should like to burn. The rooms on the floor above the two galleries are kept in tolerable repair, but are very seldom used. The civil housekeeper, who acted as my guide, offered to show me over them, but considerately added that she feared I should find them rather out of order. My respect for the integrity of my own petticoats and stockings infinitely exceeds my respect for all the Elizabethan bedrooms in the kingdom, so I positively declined exploring the upper regions of dust and dirt at the risk of soiling my nice clean clothes. The housekeeper said, "I am quite of your opinion, miss," and appeared to think me the most sensible woman she had met with for a long time past. So much, then, for the main building. Two wings are added at either end of it. The half-ruined wing on the left, as you approach the house, was once a place of residence standing by itself, and was built in the 14th century. One of Sir Percival's maternal ancestors, I don't remember and don't care which, tacked on the main building at right angles to it in the aforesaid Queen Elizabeth's time. The housekeeper told me that the architecture of the old wing, both outside and inside, was considered remarkably fine by good judges. On further investigation, I discovered that good judges could only exercise their abilities on Sir Percival's piece of antiquity by previously dismissing from their minds all fear of damp, darkness, and rats. Under these circumstances, I unhesitatingly acknowledged myself to be no judge at all, and suggested that we should treat the old wing precisely as we had previously treated the Elizabethan bedrooms. Once more, the housekeeper said, "I am quite of your opinion, miss," and once more she looked at me with undisguised admiration of my extraordinary common sense. We went next to the wing on the right, which was built by way of completing the wonderful architectural jumble at Blackwater Park in the time of George II. This is the habitable part of the house, which has been repaired and redecorated inside on Laura's account. My two rooms, and all the good bedrooms besides, are on the first floor, and the basement contains a drawing-room, a dining-room, a morning-room, a library, and a pretty little boudoir for Laura, all very nicely ornamented in the bright, modern way, and all very elegantly furnished with the delightful modern luxuries. None of the rooms are anything like so large and airy as our rooms at Limeridge, but they all look pleasant to live in. I was terribly afraid, from what I had heard of Blackwater Park, of fatiguing antique chairs and dismal stained glass and musty, frowsy hangings, and all the barbarous lumber which people born without a sense of comfort accumulate about them, in defiance of the consideration due to the convenience of their friends. It is an inexpressible relief to find that the 19th century has invaded this strange future home of mine and has swept the dirty, good old times out of the way of our daily life. I dawdled away the morning, part of the time in the rooms downstairs, and part out of doors in the great square which is formed by the three sides of the house, and by the lofty iron railings and gates which protect it in front. A large circular fish pond with stone sides and an allegorical leaden monster in the middle occupies the centre of the square. The pond itself is full of gold and silver fish, and is encircled by a broad belt of the softest turf I ever walked on. I loitered here on the shady side, pleasantly enough, till luncheon-time, and after that took my broad straw hat and wandered out alone in the warm, lovely sunlight to explore the grounds. Daylight confirmed the impression which I had felt the night before, of there being too many trees at Blackwater. The house is stifled by them. They are, for the most part, young and planted far too thickly. I suspect there must have been a ruinous cutting down of timber all over the estate before Sir Percival's time, and an angry anxiety on the part of the next possessor to fill up all the gaps as thickly and rapidly as possible. After looking about me in front of the house, I observed a flower garden on my left hand and walked towards it to see what I could discover in that direction. On a nearer view, the garden proved to be small and poor and ill-kept. I left it behind me, opened a little gate in a ring fence, and found myself in a plantation of fir trees. A pretty winding path, artificially made, led me on among the trees, and my North Country experience soon informed me that I was approaching sandy, heathy ground. After a walk of more than half a mile, I should think, among the firs, the path took a sharp turn. The trees abruptly ceased to appear on either side of me, and I found myself standing suddenly on the margin of a vast open space and looking down at the Blackwater Lake from which the house takes its name. The ground, shelving away below me, was all sand, with a few little heathy hillocks to break the monotony of it in certain places. The lake itself had evidently once flowed to the spot in which I stood, and had been gradually wasted and dried up to less than a third of its former size. I saw its still, stagnant waters a quarter of a mile away from me in the hollow, separated into pools and ponds by twining reeds and rushes and little knolls of earth. On the farther bank from me, the trees rose thickly again and shut out the view and cast their black shadows on the sluggish, shallow water. As I walked down to the lake, I saw that the ground on its farther side was damp and marshy, overgrown with rank grass and dismal willows. The water, which was clear enough on the open sandy side where the sun shone, looked black and poisonous opposite to me, where it lay deeper under the shade of the spongy banks and the rank overhanging thickets and tangled trees. The frogs were croaking, and the rats were slipping in and out of the shadowy water like live shadows themselves as I got nearer to the marshy side of the lake. I saw here, lying half in and half out of the water, the rotten wreck of an old overturned boat, with a sickly spot of sunlight glimmering through a gap in the trees on its dry surface, and a snake basking in the midst of the spot, fantastically coiled and treacherously still. Far and near, the view suggested the same dreary impressions of solitude and decay, and the glorious brightness of the summer sky overhead seemed only to deepen and harden the gloom and barrenness of the wilderness on which it shone. I turned and retraced my steps to the high, heathy ground, directing them a little aside from my former path towards a shabby old wooden shed, which stood on the outer skirt of the fir plantation, and which had hitherto been too unimportant to share my notice with the wide, wild prospect of the lake. On approaching the shed, I found that it had once been a boathouse, and that an attempt had apparently been made to convert it afterwards into a sort of rude arbour by placing inside it a firwood seat, a few stools, and a table. I entered the place, and sat down for a little while to rest and get my breath again. I had not been in the boathouse more than a minute, when it struck me that the sound of my own quick breathing was very strangely echoed by something beneath me. I listened intently for a moment and heard a low, thick, sobbing breath that seemed to come from the ground under the seat which I was occupying. My nerves are not easily shaken by trifles, but on this occasion I started to my feet in a fright, called out, received no answer, summoned back my recreant courage, and looked under the seat. There, crouched up in the farthest corner, lay the forlorn cause of my terror, in the shape of a poor little dog, a black and white spaniel. The creature moaned feebly when I looked at it, and called to it, but never stirred. I moved away the seat and looked closer. The poor little dog's eyes were glazing fast, and there were spots of blood on its glossy white side. The misery of a weak, helpless, dumb creature is surely one of the saddest of all the mournful sights which this world can show. I lifted the poor dog in my arms as gently as I could, and contrived a sort of makeshift hammock for him to lie in by gathering up the front of my dress all round him. In this way, I took the creature as painlessly as possible, and as fast as possible, back to the house. Finding no one in the hall, I went up at once to my own sitting-room, made a bed for the dog with one of my old shawls, and rang the bell. The largest and fattest of all possible housemaids answered it, in a state of cheerful stupidity which would have provoked the patience of a saint. The girl's fat, shapeless face actually stretched into a broad grin at the sight of the wounded creature on the floor. "What do you see there to laugh at?" I asked, as angrily as if she had been a servant of my own. "Do you know whose dog it is?" "No, miss, that I certainly don't." She stopped and looked down at the spaniel's injured side, brightened suddenly with the irradiation of a new idea, and, pointing to the wound with a chuckle of satisfaction, said, "That's Baxter's doings, that is." I was so exasperated that I could have boxed her ears. "Baxter," I said, "who is the brute you call Baxter?" The girl grinned again, more cheerfully than ever. "Bless you, miss, Baxter's the keeper, and when he finds strange dogs hunting about, he takes and shoots 'em. It's keeper's duty, miss. I think that dog will die." "Here's where he's been shot, ain't it? That's Baxter's doings, that is. Baxter's doings, miss, and Baxter's duty." I was almost wicked enough to wish that Baxter had shot the housemaid instead of the dog. Seeing that it was quite useless to expect this densely impenetrable personage to give me any help in relieving the suffering creature at our feet, I told her to request the housekeeper's attendance with my compliments. She went out exactly as she'd come in, grinning from ear to ear. As the door closed on her, she said to herself softly, "It's Baxter's doings, and Baxter's duty. That's what it is." The housekeeper, a person of some education and intelligence, thoughtfully brought upstairs with her some milk and some warm water. The instant she saw the dog on the floor, she started and changed colour. "Why, Lord bless me," cried the housekeeper, "that must be Mrs. Catherick's dog." "Whose?" I asked, in the utmost astonishment. "Mrs. Catherick's. You seem to know Mrs. Catherick, Miss Holcombe."
"Not personally, but I have heard of her.
Does she live here?"
"Has she had any news of her daughter?"
"No, Miss Holcombe.
She came here to ask for news."
"When?"
"Only yesterday. She said someone had reported that a stranger answering to the description of her daughter had been seen in our neighbourhood."
"No such report has reached us here, and no such report was known in the village when I sent to make inquiries there on Mrs. Catherick's account. She certainly brought this poor little dog with her when she came, and I saw it trot out after her when she went away. I suppose the creature strayed into the plantations and got shot. Where did you find it, Miss Holcombe?"
"In the old shed that looks out on the lake."
"Ah, yes, that is the plantation side, and the poor thing dragged itself, I suppose, to the nearest shelter, as dogs will, to die. If you can moisten its lips with the milk, Miss Holcombe, I will wash the clotted hair from the wound. I am very much afraid it is too late to do any good. However, we can but try."
Mrs. Catherick. The name still rang in my ears, as if the housekeeper had only that moment surprised me by uttering it. While we were attending to the dog, the words of Walter Hartwright's caution to me returned to my memory. "If ever Anne Catherick crosses your path, make better use of the opportunity, Miss Holcombe, than I made of it." The finding of the wounded spaniel had led me already to the discovery of Mrs. Catherick's visit to Blackwater Park, and that event might lead in its turn to something more. I determined to make the most of the chance which was now offered to me, and to gain as much information as I could.
"Did you say that Mrs. Catherick lived anywhere in this neighbourhood?" I asked.
"Oh dear, no," said the housekeeper. "She lives at Welmingham, quite at the other end of the county, 25 miles off at least." "I suppose you have known Mrs. Catherick for some years."
"On the contrary, Miss Holcombe, I never saw her before she came here yesterday."
"I had heard of her, of course, because I had heard of Sir Percival's kindness in putting her daughter under medical care. Mrs. Catherick is rather a strange person in her manners, but extremely respectable-looking. She seemed sorely put out when she found that there was no foundation, none at least that any of us could discover, for the report of her daughter having been seen in this neighbourhood."
"I am rather interested about Mrs. Catherick," I went on, continuing the conversation as long as possible. "I wish I had arrived here soon enough to see her yesterday. Did she stay for any length of time?"
"Yes," said the housekeeper. "She stayed for some time. and I think she would have remained longer if I had not been called away to speak to a strange gentleman, a gentleman who came to ask when Sir Percival was expected back. Mrs. Catherick got up and left at once, when she heard the maid tell me what the visitor's errand was. She said to me at parting that there was no need to tell Sir Percival of her coming here. I thought that rather an odd remark to make, especially to a person in my responsible situation.
I thought it an odd remark, too. Sir Percival had certainly led me to believe at Limeridge that the most perfect confidence existed between himself and Mrs. Catherick. If that was the case, why should she be anxious to have her visit at Blackwater Park kept a secret from him?
Probably, I said, seeing that the housekeeper expected me to give my opinion on Mrs. Catherick's parting words, probably she thought the announcement of her visit might vex Sir Percival to no purpose by reminding him that her lost daughter was not found yet. Did she talk much on that subject?
Very little, replied the housekeeper.
She talked principally of Sir Percival, and asked a great many questions about where he'd been travelling, and what sort of lady his new wife was. She seemed to be more soured and put out than distressed by failing to find any traces of her daughter in these parts. "I give her up," were the last words she said that I can remember. "I give her up, ma'am, for lost." And from that she passed at once to her questions about Lady Glyde, wanting to know if she was a handsome, amiable lady, comely and healthy and young. Ah, dear, I thought how it would end. Look, Miss Holcombe, the poor thing is out of its misery at last. The dog was dead. It had given a faint, sobbing cry. It had suffered an instant's convulsion of the limbs, just as those last words, comely and healthy and young, dropped from the housekeeper's lips. The change had happened with startling suddenness. In one moment the creature lay lifeless under our hands. 8 o'clock. I have just returned from dining downstairs in solitary state. The sunset is burning redly on the wilderness of trees that I see from my window, and I am poring over my journal again to calm my impatience for the return of the travellers. They ought to have arrived by my calculations before this. How still and lonely the house is in the drowsy evening quiet. Oh, me! How many minutes more before I hear the carriage wheels and run downstairs to find myself in Laura's arms? The poor little dog. I wish my first day at Blackwater Park had not been associated with death, though it is only the death of a stray animal.
Welmingham. I see, on looking back through these private pages of mine, that Welmingham is the name of the place where Mrs. Catherick lives. Her note is still in my possession, the note in answer to that letter about her unhappy daughter which Sir Percival obliged me to write. One of these days, when I can find a safe opportunity, I will take the note with me by way of introduction and try what I can make of Mrs. Catherick at a personal interview. I don't understand her wishing to conceal her visit to this place from Sir Percival's knowledge, and I don't feel half so sure as the housekeeper seems to do that her daughter Anne is not in the neighbourhood after all. What would Walter Hartwright have said in this emergency? Poor dear Hartwright. I am beginning to feel the want of his honest advice and his willing help already. Surely I heard something. Was it a bustle of footsteps below stairs? Yes. I hear the horses' feet. I hear the rolling of wheels. Away with my journal and my pen and ink. The travellers have returned. My darling Laura is home again at last.